everyone. Welcome to News and Brew Sports Biz, our podcast series that advocates for the financial voices in college athletics and features new developments impacting the business of college sports. I'm Katie Davis.
And I'm Ken Kurdzel. This month, we're going to an emerging issue in human resources. We have two guests joining us today. I'd like to welcome Domenica Jones, the Associate Athletic Director of HR at the University of South Florida, and Julie Nicely, President of HR Solutions at James Moore Advisory. Thank you, Julie and Domenica, for being on our podcast today.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Thanks for having us.
So today we're going to cover a new proposal from the Department of Labor that will impact minimum salary thresholds as it relates to federal overtime rules. We see many cases in the more than 35 schools that we work with where employees who likely work more than 40 hours a week have salaries that fall below the proposed salary threshold of approximately $55,000. And this is in schools of all sizes, from the mid-majors to the large power fives. Examples of positions or areas that we have seen could be impacted by the proposed change includes equipment, field and turf maintenance employees, marketing, communications, whether it's, you know, social media, digital, all sorts of people in that area, as well as executive assistants or really any position that might be a beginner level, like coordinator title, among others. So we've seen a wide variety. That's just a few. So we wanted to really point that out, that this might not seem like it could be a big deal in college athletics, but in many cases it could be, and we want to be able to dive deeper into that.
So along those lines, Julie, would you start us off by giving just a high-level overview of the 2023 DOL proposal that's increasing this exempt versus non-exempt salary threshold and how that relates to FLSA overtime rules?
Sure. So, and if anybody's been in human resources or been involved in this in the last few years, it's kind of a little bit of deja vu all over again, because there was a proposal in 2016 that got blocked, and then it came back again in 2019, which set that minimum salary level at 35 and change, which is where it still sits. The Department of Labor is of the belief that there are a lot of employees who are not receiving the wages that they deserve for working overtime hours. So the department has put together this proposal, which is now in its comment period, which would increase that minimum salary threshold in order to be considered exempt from overtime from that 35 and change up to 55 and change. And so, yeah, the impact can be significant, not only in college athletics, but think about nonprofit organizations and hospitality and other service organizations and those types of things. There's two other parts to it in the proposal. One is that highly compensated, the exemption for highly compensated individual would also increase from 107 and change to 143. And the third one is that there would be automatic updates to the threshold amounts every 3 years. So there would be an escalator every 3 years based on calculations that the department determines at that point. The department is saying that they anticipate that over 3 million additional employees will become eligible for overtime. And, you know, you don't just turn your budget on a dime. So I think that's the challenge. Is right now it's in the comment period. Once they're done with the comment period and they release the final version, the department has said within the proposal that they want it to be effective within 60 days. So nightmare scenario, They get through this comment period, they don't make a lot of changes, they publish it. Organizations will not have a lot of time in order to make sure they're in compliance. And Katie, kind of as you said, it's not different depending on what part of the country you're in. It makes no difference how large your organization is if you're in a big city or in a rural area in Iowa. The minimum is going to be the minimum is going to be the minimum.
So, you know, are these thresholds the same across the board, or are there also state requirements to be aware of?
Yeah, that's where it gets really tricky. So the Department of Labor is obviously talking about the federal level, but there's other states, including Washington, California, New York, that already have their own thresholds that supersede even this proposed increase. I think California is 64,000 a year plus in order to be considered exempt. And in New York, it can go down to the county level. So certain counties will have their own requirements. And that's why it's really important for everybody to kind of get a handle on what they need to start looking at, and don't wait until the final proposal or the final version is published before they figure out what they're going to do about it.
So what are the options that universities have if they have exempt employees below the new salary threshold? Like, what can they do now to prepare for compliance? And what should they not be doing as a means of trying to skirt around the requirements?
Right. So the first is you got to analyze your workforce and see where you are now. Identify the employees, numbers, budget, how that could impact a budget. But identify those employees that are going to be in that new salary range, so that you have to then make a decision on whether you're going to make them hourly and start paying them overtime. You can also keep them at a salary, a weekly salary, but start paying them overtime. Some organizations, again, depending on budget constraints, may take a look at the last 2 or 3 years of compensation and look at how many overtime hours might have been worked, and reduce an hourly rate in order for the compensation to be budget neutral. You know, if they do an analysis over the last 2 or 3 years, you know, and there's other kind of options, but it is getting a little bit creative in determining what the financial impact is going to be. The one thing I would say, though, is don't do anything yet. Do your analysis, know what you're getting into, put a plan in place, and then hold on, because it is a proposal. The last time, 2016, this at the very last second, it got blocked by a court in Texas. And a lot of organizations had already planned to comply with it. And when they did, they increased that salary range, which is the number one option, is you just raise everybody's salary up to the minimum and go from there. But a lot of organizations did that, and then the rule got stopped. So I would certainly be prepared, but wait and see. Let's see what the final version is going to be for this thing and when it's going to be effective, because one of the changes could be they decide to make it effective in July of 2024 or something. We just, you know, at this point, we just don't know.
No, that's good advice. And so, Domenica, imagining the strain on schools like USF, who are stuck in the middle as a G5 school that's in growth mode, you're trying to do more with less. Have you spent much time evaluating this proposed change yet? And how do you think it'll impact USF?
We looked at it a little bit, but I think the biggest issue for USF is not really where to find the money, but because we already have some of our employees are at a minimum threshold. Before I got there, that was the goal of some of our senior leadership, to make sure that we do have a minimum threshold, and that's where everybody starts, in entry-level coordinator type positions. I think the biggest issue for us is going to be, if this gets approved with such a short time frame, how are we going to figure out the compression piece? Because now we're going to have entry-level positions that are being pushed up against employees that are more experienced, making similar salaries. And then those employees, if we choose to move them up, which is going to be an added cost, are now going to be close to their supervisors, maybe even over their supervisors in salary. And so that's going to be the biggest issue for USF, not necessarily where we find the money, but it's going to be a domino effect throughout the entire department. And then, you know, we're capped in some areas. Like, we have employees that are at the highest part of their range, you know, supervisors, things like that, that are making as much as they can, and also maybe the most in our conference. So now we're taking into consideration other universities within the American Athletic Conference, and are we going to be at the top of those salary ranges? It's just going to be kind of a mess. So right now we really just need to find out, you know, when it's going to happen, what's the time frame, and then where are we going to find the money for the compression side of it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And with more and more people leaving college athletics for better pay, less stress, more work-life balance, do you anticipate it'll be even harder to either find people who bring that level of experience commensurate with a higher salary, maybe at some of those mid-level positions, or are you going to be able to ask people to work fewer hours when there's only more work to be done?
So this is a problem stemming from the pandemic still. You know, we have a lot of people leaving college athletics, taking fully remote jobs in other industries. We're also competing with professional organizations that have tons of budget for salaries and things. And, you know, we're trying to stay within the academia side of higher education. And so it's just, it's been a crisis a little bit since the pandemic. So just being able to retain the talent that we have, you know, going to different types of creative ways to be able to hire people. You know, USF has done a lot within some of those non-monetary benefits that we can talk about a little later. But, you know, I think it's more than just having a winning football team or giving out tickets to staff. It's really like, what are you doing for their professional development? You know, how are you being inclusive with the DEI and initiatives on that space? And then this next generation is just kind of in this weird lull, I guess, of, you know, demanding high pay when they first come in with limited experience. And that just several years ago, that wasn't college athletics. I mean, people were just happy to be in the business because, you know, they were able to go to games on Saturdays and be a part of something like that, but that's no more. So it is very difficult to fill positions, and now it's going to be even more difficult, you know, having to have a minimum salary that we must meet, or we have to pay overtime, which in college athletics is really tough too. That's a tricky, like, gray area that we, as HR professionals, we try to stay away from, because I mean, in all honesty, we work a lot, and, you know, there just aren't overtime dollars budgeted for that. So yeah, so it's a tricky situation. Trying to retain talent in college athletics right now is definitely a big challenge.
Yeah, and that segues perfect and kind of my next question. You know, looking at talent retention becoming an even more important element given these changes, Domenica and I were on a panel this last year at the CABMA convention discussing talent retention. And I know you have a lot of great advice to share in this area. You have a lot of good ideas you brought up then. What are some strategies implemented at USF and other institutions that you've been at that you're aware of that have been effective in retaining talent beyond the paycheck, you know, through non-monetary benefits and other employee engagement techniques?
So the biggest is going to be work from home. I did see a stat though recently that said that by 2024, over 60% of the employee workforce will be back in the office. So that's a little scary considering that is a big non-monetary benefit that we offer our employees at USF. So hopefully being able to keep that going, you know, that is a benefit for not every employee. And in that case, we do have to figure out, you know, the ones that can't work from home because they're student athlete forward facing, you know, how do we treat them in a way that they can have flexible hours or, you know, free time, mental health opportunities, things like that. But work from home, flexible schedules is a big one. A relaxed dress code. We're in Florida, it's hot. Being able to, you know, wear leggings or, you know, USF apparel and not have to be business professional all the time is a great way to retain our talent. And then focusing on things like, which is big for me, professional development, leadership development, making sure our managers and our supervisors are really equipped with good skills so that they can, you know, go to treating their employees in a way that they want to stay. I think, you know, we all know managers are a reason why employees leave most of the time. So I want to make sure that our managers, you know, have the necessary tools and resources to be great managers. And I think even if we can't pay them an astronomical amount as a salary, as if they have a great manager they're working for, sometimes that might be a way to keep them. And then we're getting ready to overhaul our orientation process. So that's another big thing, you know, making sure that you're orienting your employees right when they come in, you care about them, you know, what are you showing them or giving them on their first day, not only for their job and to be necessary in that aspect, but, you know, gear, everybody likes free clothes. And what are some fun ways to take them out to lunch? Just trying to revamp that space so that, you know, because when you have them in the door, the first day of work, that's really where they're going to determine, do I want to stay here or not? So we're trying to revamp that. I've seen it at other universities. We've done things like welcome boxes. And, you know, you had a mentor program where your mentor took you out for lunch and basically told you the ins and outs of the department and, you know, more of a personal level. And then I also would like to be able to create a stronger relationship with some of our corporate our partners. They're already, you know, supporting USF athletics in different ways, but how can they help our employees, whether that be a free car wash a month or, you know, some other type of partnership that we could have to be able to utilize them more to our advantage in a way that's not really taking away from what they're doing, but helping our employees see like, hey, we have these great partners that we offer here, campus partners too. How can we get involved with our HR team on campus to provide the best experience for our employees?
Those are all really great strategies.
Yeah.
Another strategy, and this question's for Julie, another strategy that I've been like trying to think about is, you know, when athletic departments are trying to do more with less, is to outsource certain functions to consultants. And we see this happening sometimes where firms take over an entire area, like multimedia rights, or they might bring in fractional help to fill in some gaps here and there. So what are some things that universities need to look out for as it relates to the independent contractor versus employee rules? And is there a difference if they hire a firm with a team of people to perform a function versus hiring an individual on a fractional or full-time basis?
It can be. I mean, the independent contractor, well, we could do probably three news and brews just on that subject alone, because it's tricky. And the definition is getting, it's really squirrely, quite honestly. And that's another thing that at the federal level, they think is overused and abused. So once again, we're waiting on the feds to come out with an update to how you define an independent contractor, because that was modified and simplified a couple of years ago. And now here it is, it's back again, and it's supposed to be released sometime in October on what this new definitions of how you decide if somebody's an independent contractor or not. I mean, basically comes down to sphere of control and who has the risk of profit and loss. Who has the control, who supplies the equipment, who determines the hours, all of those types of things. So independent contractors can be wonderful added benefits for that fractional activity or, you know, teams or temp agencies even. But where you need to be cautious, if it's an individual who is on their own, who only comes in and helps the university, right? If that person can do their job and do it for four different universities, you know, accountants and auditors and those types of things, they don't work on behalf of the school. They happen to work at the school at a particular time, but then they go on to other things. When you get into the one-on-ones, the individuals, that's where you really have to be careful and make sure you're following those independent contractor rules. And like I said, they're going to be doing an update where it's not going to be just those two factors of control and risk. It's going to bring in a host of other things that did exist before. So it's not quite as easy to define simply. But again, it's a great opportunity if you can find the people. I think that's the other issue now, is that there's just not as many opportunities out there and organizations that are doing that kind of thing because they're having their own problems with recruiting, right? A couple of months ago, I was in a conversation with a headhunter, somebody who does recruiting, and they were turning down jobs. They're turning down jobs because there's nobody to find in certain industries and certain type levels of positions. And I've been doing this a really long time, and I've never seen that before, where a headhunter will turn down work. And again, it's like, well, yeah, there's just nobody to find in certain industries. The other thing I would say that Domenica kind of hit on is the whole remote thing. The same goes for any consultants or any outsourced activities that you can do. You're not limited now. And I think a lot of organizations now know that they're not limited by geographics in order to bring in additional help and support. Same as your competition as a school has gone national because of the remote, and that opens up possibilities and restrictions, but so too does wanting to bring in some additional supportive consultants or outsourced or fractional opportunities that you might have.
Yeah, it's definitely a double-edged sword, the whole remote thing, because like you said, now you're competing with everybody for the same talent pool, because they can really work anywhere, but you do have the reach of additional resources out there too, if you're open to being remote. We see so many schools that are not open to remote. So I hope this is a lesson that you learn not only all of the regulatory stuff we're talking about, but this is the direction places are going and trying to find opportunities to provide that.
Absolutely. Domenica, pivoting back to you, what do you see are some other hot button HR issues that the college athletics industry is facing right now, with the huge caveat that we're not going to touch athlete employment in this podcast?
I think one of the biggest things, other than that, would be the investment in HR roles to protect the university. I think with everything going on right now with Title IX, harassment charges, all over the place, there really needs to be a way for HR professionals to kind of curb this before, either before it hits the media or, in a way where it doesn't happen at all. I know a lot of HR departments don't exist within athletics. They rely heavily on the university HR, and not that that's a bad thing, but you're not, those are not athletics minded people. They don't understand the hours, the grind, the discipline that go behind college athletics. But they're able to kind of troubleshoot things that are going on with employee relations issues, but they're not there with the employee. They don't know, they don't have a personal relationship with the employee. So I think the biggest thing, and when I was at NACTA, I was approached by several universities to be like, hey, how can we start a role like yours at our university? Because in athletics, because we know we need that. And so I think that's my number one focus right now. And that's why I'm, spreading the word, doing things like NACTA panels and stuff to for people to understand that HR is not going away. It's actually getting hotter. So the investment needs to be there. And then, we'll keep talking about work from home. That's something I am an advocate for. So whether or not it works, it's not for everybody, but I think keeping that or a flexible work option is vital. And then some fun stuff like ChatGPT is now
I
entering
love
into.
ChatGPT, so I'm all about that.
Me too. But that's entering, an HR professional's role now as well. So I've seen a lot of webinars on how it can help talent acquisition. It can write professional or job descriptions for you and stuff now. So being able to kind of enter into that AI space is going to be really interesting to see. Hopefully it stays at on the positive route. And then lastly, mental health. Obviously, we focus a lot on that in the area of student athletes, but really our senior leaders are some of our professionals within the administration of college athletics are really burnt out as well. It's a different type of burnout. And I think we need to be able to devote more resources to that area as well. Exactly what we're doing for our student athletes, but trying to help some of those people that are, overworked, underpaid, just don't feel like, they're connecting, especially after what we've been through in the last several years. So those are probably my biggest areas. Obviously there's a ton and I can talk about this forever, but I think those are some hot button items right now.
Well, those are certainly some big areas. And for those schools that either have an HR professional within athletics or even a business officer that kind of takes on that role, do you have any advice that you'd share with your peers on, how they can address some of those issues?
Yeah, I think you just have to continue to be creative in how you retain talent. Not all departments can work from home like we discussed, but there is an opportunity to reach people that may necessarily not want to move, but they can still be hired to do certain jobs in a place that they already live and they don't have to relocate. For example, graphic designers, right? They don't necessarily need to be on campus. They can have that ability, and that's the great things we have about transportation to be able to bring them to campus when needed. But you could get so many more great graphic designers if you open up the pool to allowing them to work from where they live. Especially for small, I've been in small college towns like Lubbock, Pullman, Washington. Those are not places people really want to relocate, especially as a young person, but so you're losing out on opportunities for great talent by not, looking from a broader lens in that aspect. Meals, maybe providing some different meals. I know some universities do have that ability with where student athletes are fed, staff can go there too. But just, investing in career growth, showing appreciation. I mentioned it earlier, but onboarding is very, very key. And yeah, just continuing to kind of think outside of the box when it comes to ask ChatGPT to help you with some of those.
Great advice.
Yeah, that is really good. And I love ChatGPT too. This question's for Julie. So this is the second to last question that we've got. So are there any other HR related regulations on the horizon that could impact public or private colleges and universities?
Yes, of course. There's always something coming, right? and this one impacts almost anybody that's subject to the Affordable Care Act. And it's just, and this happens every year. But the challenge is that the affordability percentage is going down, and it's going down to the lowest level it's ever been. So basically what that means is under the ACA, you cannot charge an employee for single only coverage over a certain amount. And the percentage is going down from 9% and change to 8.39%, which means that you will not be able to charge employees as much as you've done in the past. So what's happening? I have never heard of a company that doesn't get a rate increase from their health insurance company, not in years and years and years. So rates are going up, which means the universities and every other employer is going to have to take on more of the responsibility and more of the cost for the health insurance because they won't be able to pass it down to the employee. So that's coming for plan years starting in 2024. So right around the corner. Once again, everybody's got to, you know, take the budget out and see what the potential impact is. If you're small, then it might not be significant. But if you're a large university, then it could be a nice big chunk. So that has to be kept in mind. And that's probably the biggest thing coming January 1st.
Yeah. So I just thought of an idea as it relates to that. So, you know, if you're an athletic department within a larger university, maybe go talk to campus HR and finance about maybe not charging to athletics that increase cost. And that could be some kind of form of institutional support because many athletic departments are looking for that. So if it's happening across the board, you know, just maybe having those upfront conversations can go a long way as it relates to the budget side of things, but still need to be aware that this is out there because that could have a pretty large impact.
Mm-hmm.
Well, very good and very important. Now our final question moves to the brews part of our name of News and Brews, which again started out when Katie and I would, when we're visiting clients, go to craft breweries in different cities and all of that, and has now evolved to be a broader definition of brews to be really be whatever beverage of your choice. So we're going to go around and share those. Domenica, as our outside guest, let's start with you.
So I was really excited about this question, but I need some parameters because is it where I live? Is it because I've lived all over the country? So that's a tough question of what kind of brew, I guess I'm.
You know, honestly, we're open to anything. You're right. You have lived all over the country and had some and been in some neat, both rural college towns as well as large college towns. You know, so really what I think maybe just pick a favorite, like what's your favorite maybe?
Okay. So I'm a super big sour fan, love sour beers, try them everywhere I go. But honestly, my favorite is Sour Monkey from Victory Brewing. It's not even anywhere I've even lived. It's from Pennsylvania, but
that's all right.
You can buy it everywhere. It is amazing. I'm a big fan of like when your lips pucker after you've drank the sour. So
that is the opposite of what I enjoy, but you know, to each their own.
The more sour, the better. I can't get enough. So skip the fruit. I just like the sour part of it. So
that's
those
great.
Are my favorite.
Wonderful. Julie?
So I, you know, as some people call it baby beer, but I am a huge fan of Hefeweizen. And the one that's my favorite, I was too embarrassed to try to pronounce because it's from Bavaria. So I'm not even going to try it. But there is one right here at First Magnitude that's a Wakula Hefeweizen, yep. Which is actually really, really good. So that would be my favorite at the moment.
Outstanding. And Katie?
So I've been on the wine train lately because I spent some time in Italy this summer. And The nice thing about traveling overseas, when you send wine home, it's the gift that keeps on giving because it slowly trickles in over time. And so I am enjoying some Amarone, which is a wine that comes from the northern part of Italy near Venice area. It's a really good wine. So that's what I'm going to talk about this month.
Well, white or red?
Oh, it's a red wine. And this particular one is a 2011. So Amarone is one that, to taste really good, it needs to sit for a while.
Gotcha.
So yeah.
Nice.
And I am looking forward to, we are actually, Katie and I are headed down with another colleague to USF Athletics later this week. So we're going to be in Tampa, and Tampa has a brewery that I particularly love called Magnanimous Brewing. And they make great double IPAs, New England hazy style and all of that. And so I'll be having more than one because I'll have a flight to taste many of their different ones when we go down to Tampa this week. So
yeah, and Domenica, I don't know if they have sour. Do you remember if they have sours?
I don't know or not.
If, yeah, if they do, we'll bring you one for the tailgate if you're going to be tailgating on Saturday.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Julie, and thank you, Domenica, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to you all for tuning in. Cheers.
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 To learn more about the James Moore & Company Collegiate Athletics and Higher Education segments, go to jmco.com. And don't forget to sign up for Insights to get our latest industry updates, news, and events delivered straight to your inbox. You can also follow us on Twitter at JMCO Higher Ed, and on LinkedIn for the latest news as the landscape of collegiate athletics and higher education is continually evolving.